Good afternoon. I'm Arnab Gupta, the founder and CEO of Opera Solutions. I have Laura here. In this case, she's the machine in this equation. Opera Solutions, we build machine learning and machine intelligence solutions to drive profitability and growth for commercial customers globally. We are a center of machine learning. We have about 220 machine learning scientists who extract patterns from large data sets. And we are at the forefront of the big data revolution that we're looking at. So what I'm going to share with you today are insights and observations as we have been building the company and having observations of this man versus machine conflict and what we have learned. To a significant extent, we are already living in the matrix as the way I see it. We are bombarded by the products of machine intelligence today. The credit score you have, the prices you pay in a supermarket, the customer service calls you receive, all of this are algorithmically derived and you're bombarded with it. In science, in sports, in trading, in capital markets, in social discourse, increasingly the machine is part of what we do. We do not even often recognize the role it plays in our daily social and economic lives. And this is only the beginning. The oil that is fueling this revolution is big data, and machine intelligence is its refinery. And what's happening increasingly is that as the machines get smarter, often, and they are becoming more of a black box, they create a sense of alienation between people and the machines because people increasingly do not understand the outputs of the machine, though they're influenced by it and their behaviors are shaped by it, which has, of course, given rise to the whole man versus machine conflict. And Hollywood obviously loves the conflict. You know, you have, it actually goes back in time to Fritz Lang and Metropolis, you know, where machine dominated man. Then you have, you know, the famous 2001, where you have a malevolent machine. You have the Star Trek series and the Borg, where it's man plus machine, except it's machine plus man. You have, you have the Terminator and Skynet, you know, where machine destroys man. So this whole conflict has become part of our the way we look at things. You know, and in the course of my work some time ago, I was talking to a hedge fund trader who's made a lot of money doing high-frequency trading, and he basically said, he says, why do I need people? I mean, I just keep investing in machines and investing in the algorithms to substitute what my people do not so well. And that's what I'm going to keep doing. And while we were building the company up, you know, we had to go through the downturn of 2008 and 2009, which if you really think about it, this is the first recession which was caused by the spectacular failure of machine intelligence. Credit default swaps, the whole mortgage meltdown, all of this was guided by machine intelligence, and look what happened. So I bet my company in terms of building a capability around machine intelligence, and it became increasingly clear that just by focusing on that, there's also the potential of creating a Frankenstein. So there had to be a way in which man and machine could work together. So we went on a journey trying to look for the balance between how machines work with man. Now, I'm a chess player, and if you really think about it, this man-machine conflict has in a way been played out in the world of chess. As some of you know, chess prowess is measured by an ELO rating. And if you look at the growth of the intelligence of the chess machines, you will find that it's grown from a fairly low level, well below human capacity, all the way to a rating of about 3,200 today. And this is, by the way, a game that is being played out in every venue where machine intelligence plays a role. If you overlay this with what humans did, the best of them, that is. I mean, you have Garry Kasparov, who was arguably the best chess player and the most powerful chess player who ever lived. You look at the top 10 human ranking. Somewhere in 2003, the crossover stopped. So if you think back to when there was Deep Blue, and it was a contest, you know, it was man and machine, who's going to win. Garry Kasparov was emissary of humanity, and you know, he kept fighting the battle till he lost the battle, and now it's a non-issue. People just don't think about this anymore. But if you talk to Garry Kasparov, he, while he's the loser and therefore he should be the one, in a sense, most bitter, he thinks that this is an extraordinary opportunity for people, because he believes that man and machine together are far more powerful than each other. So just let's listen to what he has to say.
I wouldn't believe, if I was told beforehand, that relatively weak players beat a couple of very strong grandmasters using relatively good chess playing engines just because of the superior process. I believe that chess is a unique playing field to look for the combination of the machine's power and a human's abilities. We are good at something that machines are bad at, and vice versa. Because when we have a game between two computers, one or two advices from humans could change everything to make sure that machine doesn't go the wrong way. You have two humans playing, one or two advices from the computer could be decisive. By adding this, the quality of intuition to the decision-making process, we can dramatically improve the result. Using human intuition and finding the way to sort of extract the most out of the computers could prove to be the way to move these frontiers way beyond the horizon.
So let me sort of reemphasize what Garry Kasparov is really saying. He's saying an average chess player, that is myself, can beat Garry Kasparov or very strong grandmasters or any chess machine consistently. The power lies in the combination because of the perspectives humans bring in terms of their creative abilities versus what the machine brings, which is extraordinary calculating abilities. What he does not mention is a peculiar side effect of this contest in chess particularly. What they found is that as people started playing with the machines increasingly, the chess IQ or IQ generally increased of the top players. The top 100 players are now substantially better than what they used to be, because it actually strengthens the cognitive abilities of the people. That is something that they have discovered, and they've actually looked at this in other venues, and it's been proven to be true there as well. But in the end, you will say, okay, this is a game, it's a contained game, a defined problem, a defined outcome, and how much can you generalize from this one example? So now I'm going to go into another game, which is jigsaw puzzles. But this is a jigsaw puzzle with a difference. This is a jigsaw puzzle with national security implications. DARPA had a contest some time ago, which was called the Shredder Challenge. Basically, they took five documents and they put it into 10,000 separate pieces, and they had a challenge for people to put it together. And why would they have this challenge? Because in the DoD, oftentimes, they have to recreate documents, they have to extract intelligence from documents which have been shredded. So they wanted to find a more powerful way of doing it. Otavio Good and his team won this contest, and they did it in the record time of about a month. And he approached this whole problem as a man and machine problem. And we went and talked to him a couple of weeks ago to find out what is his special sauce, what's his secret. And his answer was so revealing that we decided to tape him. So I want to share that tape with you.
For as long as computers have been around, there's been this boundary of where the human does a job and where computers do a job. Or even to generalize it more, for as long as machines have been around, there's been a boundary. And as technology progresses, the computers are moving more and more into the human realm. So DARPA put a bunch of shredded documents on the internet, and they said whoever gets these things reconstructed first gets $50,000. DARPA told me that about 9,000 people signed up for the challenge. When we started, I didn't believe anybody would solve the whole thing. The challenges looked incredibly difficult. There were about 10,000 little shredded pieces of paper that had to be reconstructed. Some crazy people would try to do it completely manually, just like a jigsaw puzzle. Some crazy people would try to automate the whole thing. And what we did is an approach where we used humans combined with computers to solve the problem. So it works well for the computer to do large-scale dumb work and for the human to take things to a slightly higher level and make judgment calls and things like that. The idea is there's the reconstructed shredded document on the screen, kind of like you might see a jigsaw puzzle on a screen, and you click where you want the computer program to recommend a piece and kind of verify whether or not you like it. If you like it, you say, okay, let's place that piece. And then you know, do that again. You click, you like it, you place the piece. You click, and then maybe the computer recommends something that's not quite right, and so you have to look through a couple pieces to find the right one. Sometimes you find the right one, and sometimes you just move on to another thing and try to find a piece in another place and keep placing. The computers are capable of doing a lot of stupid stuff. The humans are capable of doing a little bit of stuff that requires extra thinking. There's a lot of things as it relates to context that the human user can understand that the computer will not be able to understand. So the computer will look at the ink on the edges of the paper and some other simple things, but the human can put together a whole word in their head and say, okay, I'm just missing a little piece from this whole word. And it makes sense to a human, and the computer wouldn't be able to make sense of most of a word with one piece missing. So the human is able to fill in the blanks on the more advanced things. So this is the completed puzzle number one. I think each puzzle took a little bit less than 1 week. So the first puzzle was, I believe, about 200 pieces. The second puzzle here was, I think, about 400 pieces. And each successive puzzle had more and more pieces, and in theory, at least, was more difficult. But since we were developing our code, we were developing our technology, by the time we got to puzzle number 5, that was probably the most easy for us. All told, in puzzle 5, there were about 6,000 pieces. There were 20 of these sheets. We tried to take the things that the human was doing and make the computer do that functionality so that the human could work at a higher and higher level. There were a bunch of us. There were 3 programmers and then a bunch of friends who were helping to place puzzle pieces. We put a lot of time into this. It took a month of all of our time outside of work. We would go to work, we would do our work, and when we were done with that, we would work on the DARPA project until it was bedtime. It wasn't really about the money. We wanted to have fun. We wanted to have exclusive worldwide bragging rights.
So that's Ottavio. So what is it that he was really doing here? I mean, first the first lesson we draw from this is that, you know, he programmed the computer to do the stupid stuff, as he calls it, except it's really hard work for humans to do. But he also recognized that there would be a limit to the how far you could push it. In other words, he created a signal library, a readable index of data. But more important, he did this to bring the problem down to human scale. And you will see this is increasingly the way human and machine interact. Because that allowed people to do experimentation, to do querying. And then the last point here is, and this is something which we've increasingly seen in man-machine collaboration, there is a learning loop. You see on the right-hand side there are all those dots. What he discovered as he was going through this exercise was that each copying machine had a unique fingerprint, a unique signature, as exemplified by these dots, which told him where to set the pieces, and suddenly this complex problem became radically simplified, and he solved it. Now, I've shown you 2 examples. I've shown you the example of chess and, you know, the one with DARPA. And these are all contained situations, and as we looked around, we found more and more of such instances of man and machine being more powerful than each other. But the question that came to us was, is this something that is generalizable? I mean, is the truth that the reach of the human mind is always beyond the reach of the machine? Is that, in fact, a generalizable truth? And we searched far in the world of business and eventually went to the world of academia to study the cognitive systems that they were looking at to see what makes the human mind special. And we were particularly captivated and influenced by Professor Deacon, who is the chair of the Department of Anthropology at UC Berkeley. And he spent his life studying the cognitive systems of living things. I mean, he has 2 books. One is called Symbolic Species, and the other one is called Incomplete Nature, where he's distilled his learning, and we spent some time with him. Essentially, what he's studying is what makes the human brain different. You know, to brain development, origin of language and evolution. And he posits 3 levels of cognition. The first level he calls iconic. Iconic is, if you think of a baby, iconic is recognizing a ball as being a ball or a rattle as being a rattle. In the animal kingdom, it's a moth which has the coloring of the bark of a tree, and that moth finds a tree with a similar coloring as a way of camouflaging itself for survival. So it has a cognitive ability to recognize some iconic connections. For a computer, that is, you know, recognizing a song for what it is, or recognizing a flower pot for what it is. So that's iconic. The next level is indexic. Indexic is in the world of, you know, world of human is a bat and a ball. It's things that associate with each other. In the animal kingdom, indexic is, you know, for take baboons, it is a certain noise means that it is danger. And one thing Professor Deakin found was that the cognitive capacity of non-human primates and others is limited because it's designed to capture indexic associations. It doesn't really go much beyond that. This is where, of course, the computer excels. And this is where it's getting stronger and stronger and stronger. The ability to mine indexic associations, to be able to draw conclusions from data at a massive scale. So when we talk about machine intelligence, we're looking at the combination of the iconic and the indexic. Where the human being comes in, it's symbolic. And symbolic is something which is very, very unique to humanity, because unlike baboons and apes and dogs and the like, what's happening here is that the mind is designed to abstract up. No matter what it is, we are abstracting up. So for a child, that would be looking at a set of toys, looking at a cardboard box and calling a box a toy as well, and aggregating it all. It's very rare in non-human living things to have a symbolic ability. You know, for instance, there's a dog in Germany which can recognize up to 186 different toys or things. And in this one dog once was asked to get something which was not one of the 186, and it did find it, and people were startled. The truth is, for people, if a four-year-old could not do that, we would be startled. It is so different. For the machine, this is particularly difficult. There have been a lot of attempts to create sort of symbolic reasoning in machines, and it has, you know, it sometimes brings an edge into it. Sort of, for instance, they use techniques such as restricted Boltzmann machines and the like, which is attempting to fill in blanks, but with great difficulty. What symbolic reasoning, in a sense, is about wholeness. If you think about it, the human mind, even if they're just two pieces of information, we will always complete the picture. Right or wrong, we will always complete the picture. It's about wholeness, it's about understanding, it's about synthesis. And it is also not constrained by data. It is in the realm of imagination, dreaming, conjecture, possibility. It's outside the realm of big data. It's actually big human, if you think about it. And the reason why this exists is because it's a byproduct of consciousness. Emotion is the motive force. You know, Antonio Damasio, who's a very prominent scientist in neuroscience, you know, he's been studying the roots of consciousness, and he's found that consciousness is always accompanied by emotion. So this notion, even Ray Kurzweil's notion, that the more iron we put to work, it'll somehow become alive. Unless it gains emotion, it will not. That's what Damasio says. So this is in the realm of uniquely human. So when you think about the combination of iconic and indexic, that is the purview increasingly of the machine. And the purview of humanity is symbolic, which always rises above it. No matter what the indexic representation of reality, the human mind completes the picture, because creativity is built into symbolic reasoning. It is a core part of it. It is a necessary part of it. So what does that mean? So what we're looking at is the man plus machine combination is what I call integrated cognition, a system of cognition where all three components work together. That's what man plus machine really represents. But there are a lot of complications associated with this. For instance, if you have poor indexic, that results in flawed symbolic. Let me give you an example from Daniel Kahneman, who is won a Nobel Prize in economics, but he's not an economist. He's a behavioral psychologist. And he written a masterful book called Thinking Fast and Slow. And this is a puzzle or a test he put to people. He says, Steve is very shy and withdrawn, invariably helpful, but with little interest in people or in the world of reality. A meek and tidy soul, he has a need for order and structure and a passion for detail. The question he put to people is Steve more likely to be a librarian or a farmer? And when the test and the results came back, most people said librarian. And what I said was that I've met many very aggressive librarians because I did not return a book when books still existed. And the reason for that is just statistical, because there are many more farmers. You know, even if that is a dominant trait among librarians, which I dispute, it's 20 times more likely that it's a farmer. But the way our minds work, you know, we create the indexic reality that makes sense to us. And that's how we come to a conclusion. Now, this is a relatively benign example, but this is also the roots of why prejudice exists, why discrimination exists, because people tend to abstract up, just like they would think a librarian has a certain characteristic. That's why poor indexing results in poor symbolic things. So the machine is helpful here in terms of leveling the playing field as such. In essence, the promise here is rich indexing creates rich symbolic. If you think about it, when people, through their lives, you know, people when they're young, they have a very strong indexic ability. They can remember a lot of facts. And the symbolic ability is oftentimes not so clear. And over time, as you grow older, as is happening to me, I tend to forget stuff. But then the symbolic layer starts getting richer and richer, you know, which is what's oftentimes called wisdom. In this, the South by Southwest, there's music. You know, they have the 10,000 hours of practice. The foundation of that is sort of an indexic foundation, which then allows them to create art at a very, very high level. So the goal here is to create this rich indexic foundation to allow humans to get to a rich symbolic level. But there is a challenge here, because if you think about it, even in Professor Deakin's framework, you know, we cannot communicate easily with the non-human primates. The computer here, which creates the indexic and the iconic representation, is an alien being. So how do you foster this rich symbolic thinking? How do you connect the two? This interface is absolutely crucial. And what you find is that I went and talked to Professor Deakin about this over the last month or two. And what he said was that computers have a way of, it's like a telescope or a microscope. It has the ability to bring things down to human scale. What he called is mesoscopic. But what he also said is that you need a visual way of communicating with the machine first. What he was saying is, for to communicate with humans, the indexic must become iconic. So if you think of the interface, the Apple, the iPhone, the iPad, what they are in essence done is, they've taken a lot of information and they've made it more and more iconic so that people can interface with it. But visual language alone doesn't do it, because what this we have to foster here is not just an understanding of what the computer or the machine is doing. What you have to foster is a collaboration and an interrogation of what the machine is doing so that people can understand it. And this is an area of experimentation and innovation that is happening today. And what people are finding increasingly that this is in the realm of play, that the way people actually understand it is by stress testing it, by playing with it, by making a game of it. You notice Ottavio, when he was doing the jigsaw puzzle, he made a game of it. So what I'm now going to, before I get to the next part of this and extend this further, my fervent belief is that some of the greatest innovations that will have to happen is in this interface between machine and man, how the two communicate with each other, how you make the two come together. Because as this thing gets fostered, it releases enormous productivity and gain. So to tell you how this actually is progressing, I'm now going to enter into the world of medicine. Now, except for the few of us who are young and believe they're immortal, this affects us all. Now, Dr. Eric Lander, you know, who is the director of the Broad Institute at MIT Harvard, he gave a lecture a couple of years ago, in 2010, where he made a comment which has always stayed with me. He said, This is what the Broad Institute does. It's in the field of computational biology. They use machine intelligence to understand disease genomics more. So what he said was, if you were sitting in the year 2020 and you were looking back into the year 2010, he said the difference in medicine would be the same difference as in chemistry, pre-periodic tables, post-periodic tables. He said we are living in an era where you have Moore's law on a log scale. Now, many such forecasts have been done in the past, but the direction is set in terms of how fast this is moving. And, you know, when I'm not working on my business, I am also work with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on HIV eradication in India. And so I've been observing this phenomena of how, computational biology and other forms to create an HIV vaccine. And many of you may not know, but the HIV virus first originated in monkeys, I think, in Mozambique. So people have been trying for the longest time to create a 3D structure of HIV virus in monkeys. And for 15 years, they've thrown the best of machine intelligence against it and essentially stumped. Until somebody in this field, like Ottavio, said, let's reconceptualize this challenge as a man and machine challenge. Now, what I'm going to show you, what they did was they exposed this structure, turned it into a game, and exposed it to a bunch of gamers. Some of you may be even aware of this thing because it came out in Nature, and the game was folded. And what I'm going to share with you is how they did it.
A huge amount of energy into playing games on computers. So I think projects like this can channel that energy into solving real-world problems. And that's a way in which everyone can contribute that really hasn't been there before.
It's essentially a 3D jigsaw puzzle. You're given a protein which comprises of a backbone and individual side chains. And by moving these around, changing the interactions, your score either goes up or down.
Scientists are interested in working out the three-dimensional structures of proteins because they help understand how the proteins carry out their jobs, what they do inside cells. And the principle behind the prediction of protein structures on a computer is that we've known for a long time that all the information needed to determine the structure of a protein is in the amino acid sequence of the protein. So from genome sequences, we can translate those into amino acid sequences using the genetic code, and now we have this amino acid sequence. Turns out that the structure that proteins fold to is almost always the lowest energy structure for that amino acid sequence. So the structure prediction problem then is finding the lowest energy structure for that amino acid sequence. And the reason it's hard is that there's so many different possible configurations. Has is they can look at a complicated thing like a big protein, sort of zoom in on the regions that probably most need to be reworked. And we give them visual cues. The regions that are high in energy locally are red, and so they sort of stand out that they're like, you need to do something here. You can imagine where you come home in the evening and you can either stay up all night playing Halo, or you can be designing an HIV vaccine with people all around the world. I mean, which would you be happier saying you did when you went to work in the morning? People out there are discovering not only alternative protein structures, but new approaches to solving the problem. So they're really doing scientific research, even though most of the players are not practicing scientists.
We're here to provide a sort of refinement to the folding algorithms that protein servers use to try and do this automatically. As we get better and feedback to the Baker Lab, the automated algorithm for the computers will get better.
I think it's important to remember that this problem was solved in 10 days. Now imagine 15 years, 10 days. What if the original person was like Ottavio and conceptualized this as a man and machine problem? I mean, how many lives would have been saved? So moving on, going into the everyday life of business and commerce, I mean, I'm a business person, and my purpose of my company is to get a commercial advantage using these kinds of methods. And the goal here is to meet the promise of Garrison Keillor to use these technologies so that everybody is above average. That's the goal. Now, to tell you that these kinds of transformational effects have in fact happened in history, I do not know how many of you are aware, but in the 13th century in Europe, to do addition, you needed to get an advanced degree because, Roman numerals, it took a lot of work to basically add Roman numerals. So as a result, bookkeeping was a very difficult thing to do, and it was a constraining effect on commerce. And then came the zero, which was, in a sense, the machine learning unit of its time. And it transformed commerce in Europe because suddenly lots of people could balance the books, could understand where they are going, how much money they were making, and so on and so forth. Appears to be a relatively trivial addition and completely transformational. I believe we are at just such a point today. So let's just, in order to understand this phenomena, let's just talk about the classroom. In most classrooms, we are all familiar with it. You have, the 80-20 rule. You have the 20% of people who do brilliantly and or well, and then you have 80% of very, very erratic, which is the group to which I unfortunately belonged. And the thing here is that 80% for a variety of reasons, always remains 80%. And the interesting thing is if you look at business today and you look at HR departments, the extraordinary billions of dollars that are spent trying to do what that much more expert teacher could not manage to do, make a human being more expert. But yet the money keeps going into it. It's the very definition of insanity. Keep doing something over and over again, even though you know the outcome. So the promise here is how do you take the 80% and bring them down up to the 20% level so that the floor is redefined, so that the productivity is released. This is where a lot of this technology is beginning to go and be applied, and we are still in the very early stages. I'm going to just show you one example from the work we do, which I think will make the much larger point, which is in the very prosaic work of auto remarketing. In the automobile sector, about 17 million cars get sold every year. They're sold in these huge auction barns. They take 30 to 40 seconds per car to accept or reject a bid. And the way people normally have done this is, they've essentially, like if you've seen the movie Moneyball, you remember the scene where people were saying, well, his left hip is this and his right hip is that, and therefore he's a good ball player. That's how they would have done it historically. So we tried to inject a machine intelligence solution into the equation. Watch.
An auction environment is one of the most chaotic environments that our customers have to deal with. We could have as many as 100 cars being sold every single day. Each one of these cars comes through a lane where there are dozens of people shouting and hollering and making gestures. And every 30 or 40 seconds, the representative of the seller needs to decide, am I going to sell this car and accept the price that's being offered, or am I going to hold it for another day? My name is Alan Ewalt, and I work for Opera Solutions, and we've been working on an auto auction price optimizer on an iPad. Traditionally, somebody would have to look at several different data sources to get all this information, put it together in their head, and then make a final adjustment to the floor price on a piece of paper. Today, we allow them to have all this information in the palm of their hand in an iPad as they walk around and take a look at the cars before every auction. The analytics behind this iPad application actually comes from rocket science, of all things. And if you imagine a rocket heading off towards its target, it's receiving dozens of streams of data from its sensors, and it needs to make small corrections towards its target. It needs to identify what's the real signal versus what's noise coming from the sensors. Now, think about an auto auction. You have people making dozens of bids for a car, but you never really know which of those bids are just noise and which ones of those actually represent the true market price of that car. Our model can do that.
Books, records, got it all, guys.
From the headquarters perspective, they've seen a reduction in the variation between the actual price a car is able to achieve at auction and the floor price. That means more money that they can save by avoiding either overpricing or underpricing. For the humans who are actually selling at the auction, they've seen that their time has been freed up, so they can do what they know best. They can take a look at the cars, they can converse with the dealers, they can get a read on how an auction is going, something that they didn't have time to do before because they had to manually take all of these steps. A human is really good at understanding the emotion on the floor. A machine could also do a good job because we could statistically see how much cars have sold for in the past and how much they've sold for in recent history. But if you combine the two together, the understanding of the human dynamic of an auction and the understanding of this large amount of data, then you can get a really great result.
Now, this is a relatively straightforward example. But if you really, if you take this kind of a capability and look into the world of education, for instance, people have a very hard time with math oftentimes to move from geometry to calculus. I mean, this whole process of taking the indexic, which is all the underlying complexity which people find forbidding, comparing it and converting it to iconic, and then making it into a game so that people can access it. A lot of the breakthroughs will come in making these kinds of translations. And in day-to-day world, in customer service, for sales forces, for collection agents, and the like, the power of this is not even in the beginning of getting tapped. So we believe that this is really, like the zero, has the potential to transform business across the globe. So we've taken it thus far from, you know, from chess to jigsaw puzzles to medicine to, you know, cars. Where is all this actually going? What next? When I was a child growing up in India and belonging to the 80% and not doing my homework, I used to read a lot of science fiction. I was a big fan of Isaac Asimov and his Foundation series, you know, where he had this whole concept of psychohistory laying out, which basically said that using this kind of analytics and much further, of course, you can predict the shape of human society and its evolution and influence it. And it always captured my imagination, which is one of the reasons why I even started my company. I do not know if you people have seen the movie. Many people have, Minority Report, you know, Spielberg's Minority Report. And you know, in this movie, what is a lot of people...
Hello, Mr. Yakamoto. Welcome back to the Gap. How those assorted tank tops work out for you?
If you remember this, I mean, for me, this was this and a couple of other scenes that we'll never forget. And, you know, this movie was, you know, was supposed to be in 2051, many, many years from now. But the technology exists today. And there's a company we are working with called Affectiva. This is a company that has the largest database of human emotions in the world. They've captured it in what's called facial action units. And their goal is nothing less than creating an iconic and an indexing database of everything that the face does. They are applying this in a multitude of fields, in autism, in market research, in understanding customer behavior as you observe, as in the process of shopping and so on and so forth. So let me show you what they have to say about themselves.
Affectiva is a spin-out from the MIT Media Lab, founded by two scientists who met working together on technologies to help children on the autism spectrum.
When I started this area of research, I was, you know, my goal was to get computers to be more emotionally intelligent, and I then quickly realized that we can leverage that ability of emotionally intelligent machines to help augment, you know, what humans can do so well.
Affectiva scientifically measures emotional response and quantifies it in ways that was previously not possible using machines. It starts with the lowest level of measurement, and that's a facial action unit, which was defined by Paul Ekman in the early 70s. And each one of them is very minute. So, for example, a lip corner pull is simply just my lips pulling forward. So to get to an accurate emotional inference, you need to do things like combine them. In order to train the affect software to recognize human facial expressions, it itself has to be trained.
So the way the science works is that, you ask the viewer swapped and they simply turn their webcam on and we stream the video in real time back to our servers. Our algorithms are sitting there taking frame by frame, looking for the face, identifying where the face region is, and then locking onto the main feature points of the face. So things like eyes, nose, eyebrows. We're able to identify where these facial feature points are and track their movement across the video. The machine is able to combine these facial actions over time to give you an indicator of the person's emotional state.
One of the reasons for using an automated technology like this is that it can capture how people feel without them having to articulate it and without them having to find the words to do that. And it therefore allows us to do that in a very unobtrusive way for the participant. So we may be recording from 150 people, but we end up with one graph at the end of that that shows where that group of people as a whole tended to smile and where they tended to frown and where they tended to look shocked.
So in a one-on-one dialogue, while it's very, I think, easy and intuitive for two individuals to gauge each other's responses, the very notion that that response can be measured and then tabulated allows it to scale in a repeatable and predictable way that really isn't possible just using people, individuals. And I think that's where the complement between what people can do and what machines can do is really powerful.
It's actually very fascinating that we are able to leverage the power of machines and computers to do something that is so fundamentally, social and human, like reading emotions. A lot of individuals on the autism spectrum find it really hard to process what's happening on the face in real time and at the same time, incorporate it into how they're responding to a conversation. And so where technology can help is that a lot of, the facial coding technology that we're building can do some of the grunt work of processing what's happening on the face. So, for example, it could tell an individual on the spectrum that someone looks interested or someone looks confused and maybe suggest ways they can adapt the conversation to handle that type of information.
And so there's a huge benefit in having a technology like Affdex, which can be used both to interpret the emotions of the autistic child and also to help them interpret the emotions of those that they interact with.
So what you've seen thus far is a series of examples, and the concept of man and machine is really a better way of stating it is that the machine increasingly is a prosthesis of the human mind. It's its very extension, because in almost every situation we've seen, the two in combination are a lot more powerful than they are individually. And So as we go forward, when you look at the power of technology, what you find is that it's often been very disruptive. And here, the fear is the following, because as the big data revolution and the volume of data keeps growing, our inability to understand it is also expanding day by day. But at the same time, we see is that if we can harness it, particularly through the medium of conversation and interaction, it can be bought to have a prosthetic effect. I mean, I remember some time ago looking at this situation where I think there was this person. I mean, a question I put to people was, if you were sitting in the year 1990 and somebody said that somebody would be disqualified from running in the Olympics because they had a prosthetic, would you believe it? And then in 2005, that's exactly what happened. So increasingly, the machines are an extension of us and a part of us, but it's mostly been physical thus far. For the first time here, the technology is being developed, so it has become an extension of the mind itself. And you saw in this case with the last one you saw, like for instance, autism, where they've taken something which is absolutely innate to the human because a part of the brain is devoted to facial recognition. It's its very purpose. And they have indexicized it and iconicized it in such a way that it can be brought to an autistic person so that they can interpret emotions using the power of the machine. Also, what's happened historically, physical machine has substituted for human labor. So there's always been dislocation, it's created the rise of the Luddites. In fact, I was reading a news item the other day because there had been some elections in India a month ago, you know, where there was this state party, which in the last election, which had lost, had said they were going to eliminate and force all government agencies not to use computers as a way of creating employment. And they lost, thank God. This time, you know, they had a renewal. They came out with a completely different promise. They said they're going to give every high school and college student a free computer, free tablets, and then they went and won. So this is an example where, you know, so enlightenment is possible. People are beginning to understand how it expands human capability and takes it to another level. So as this whole revolution takes place and as the technology begins to get more and more interlinked, see, in some ways, when you look at, you know, people talk about extraterrestrials and how would we communicate, the reality is we have an extraterrestrial in our midst, you know, which is called machine intelligence. And we are right now trying to find out how do we communicate with an inanimate object like this in a way which extends ourself. So the real promise of this revolution is that it will allow us to and free us to become finally and truly really human. Thank you. Time for questions.
We have time for questions.
Okay.
If you have questions, please use the microphone there so that this is being podcast, so that can get picked up. Anybody have any questions?
Hello. Hello, 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 hello. The moon. thank you. Really inspiring talk. I wonder if you've given any thought to when you were talking about it, the machine being like a prosthesis for the mind. Have you given any thought to access to the machine and how that might run along economic fault lines, or is it going to be something that the wealthy have access to, or is there any thoughts about that?
See, like with any transformational change, initially it is the wealthy who have access to it. But the power of technology is, above all, it gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, right? So this is the ultimate democratizing force, because if you look at, you know, the Occupy Wall Street movement and the like, you have an increasing divide which is largely driven by, oftentimes, education. So the question is, how do you use these capabilities to give access in a cheap way to the population at large? This is what's happening in India right now, actually. Because, you know, one of the things the country has realized is, you know, the division is only going to expand. So bringing this technology and these methods down to the bottom 30% of society is the only way that the educational force can be let loose. So I believe that initially, you're right, I think it'll reinforce divisions as more and more people use it for the 20% to become even stronger. But over time, the sheer inexorable impact of reducing costs, Moore's law at play, will make it available to all.
Like your examples about, you know, medicine and pricing, do you have any other areas that you think big data and this type of analysis between man and machine are going to be affected by other verticals?
You see, I think they all will. I see the problem you have right now is that the two worlds are divided. You know, you have sort of the esoteric world of the data scientist building very complex algorithms, black box solutions, and that's the reigning paradigm. But what these examples are showing is that they are short-circuiting what is indeed possible, because their notion is, just like that hedge fund investor I'm talking about, that somehow that is the way towards increased productivity. And what all these examples are showing is that it falls well short of potential. So when we work with companies and they have analytics departments and scientific groups and quants and whatnot, we're saying you're missing the boat, because it is in this symbiosis that the answer lies. You know, so I think there will be, the process it will take is there'll be these leading examples of people who are gaining a commercial advantage. People will want to know why. Like with everything, it will follow a process, but I do not think there's a single aspect of human commercial or non-commercial activity which is immune from this phenomena. I think this is a transformational effect. It's really not so much about big data, because what is big data but just oil in the ground? It's about insight, it's about intelligence, and it's about the ability of people to use it to economic and social effect.
Really inspired by sort of your collaborations with Gates and potentially other organizations working in the social sector. And the vast majority of organizations in the social sector don't necessarily have the resources to capture the potential of machine learning that you have demonstrated here. And I'm wondering, is there any sort of entry point for organizations that have massive amounts of data and sort of a mission orientation that could deliver social impact in a way that would be quicker than sort of relying solely on those organizations that have lots of money and can employ folks?
The interesting thing is when we were dealing with HIV eradication in India, we were forced to rethink the operating model, because what was happening was the standard NGO model in social service is that you have a bunch of experts who know a lot, who go and speak to the disadvantaged and tell them what to do. And they give them tools and techniques, but it's very much like the classroom writ large. That's basically what happens. What we realized was that the HIV problem in India as such was concentrated among sex workers, and there were about 500 community of sex workers where it was concentrated. That was the center of the epidemic. And we also realized that no amount of telling people to such a marginalized community would have an impact. So what we had to do is that we had to turn the pyramid upside down and empower the community itself by tools and technologies and methods, even though they were illiterate. And that's what we kind of did. We didn't use all the most advanced techniques, but that's the direction in which we took it. And so, yes, they have the data, they have the ability, but I think it takes somebody in leadership with true imagination to transform what they're doing.
There was a recent report from McKinsey which said that by next year there would be about 150,000 gap in demand and supply of people who understand big data. Now, given that this is part science, part art, what are your thoughts in terms of how do we educate and bring a critical mass of people who can help the industry take advantage of this knowledge?
See, I think it's going to be, it's going to be lots of hits and misses. See, ultimately, how do you take something that is scarce and make it abundant is only through the medium of technology. This notion that this is sort of about labor and about smart people is fundamentally mistaken. Because what you have to do is convert this, because the more usable you make it, the more you deal with technology solutions, the more accessible it becomes. So I think the way they've looked at it is as in a service model, maybe because it's McKinsey, right? And somehow it takes a service framework to solve the problem. And yes, for a while that is true. But the whole point here is to create scalable solutions, whether in the social sector or whether in customer service or anything. So yes, there's going to be a period of dislocation and hit and miss. But I believe, like with every single technology change, the role of the data scientist will become different.
Hey, I was just reading an article about a new technology that's like a computer game that people with suffering from schizophrenia can play this game for a certain amount of hours, like 80 hours or something, and then after that, it helps them to better distinguish between normal reality and the reality that they're experiencing. Do you have any thoughts on this or knowledge about this kind of games and technology that you could share?
See the thing about these games in terms of this. How the games work, like we saw, is that, people have often thought that, they tell their children don't play video games, because they're going to get dumber. It's actually the other way around. They get smarter, because it strengthens their cognitive. In a sense, it's giving food to the brain. So what the effects you see is that this way of exercising the mind and finding ways to exercise the mind gives food to the brain and makes it stronger. So even though that impact might be temporary with schizophrenia, but the impact is observable. See, this is why I would say the classroom and all these places, this ability to have the two systems interconnect to truly create an integrated cognition system is the only way the power of big data will finally be realized.
you. So there's a lot of talks about big data at Southwest. Obviously, it's a big subject, you know, very popular topic right now. You talked about it in a very specific way. Can you just talk a bit more about the context within which, you know, sort of the landscape of what people are doing with big data, sort of put what your take on it is into context?
A couple of things here. This whole big data phenomena, people are approaching it like it was yesterday, and let me tell you why. The dominant framework of yesterday was, let's build the AS1 dam over and over again. Let's have larger and larger storage, because that's what we did. And so what you find is all the major SAP, Oracle, IBM invest heavily in greater and greater storage. But this is not a problem that is going to be solved by storage, because the rate of data generation is far exceeding the ability to capture and mine. You know, so what's increasingly happening is people are beginning to realize it's really not about the data, it's about what you do with the data. And that's what you're going to find over the next 12 to 18 months, that the shift will begin to occur as it becomes obvious to corporations that there is simply no way by creating Hadoop and the rest and complex processing technologies that you're going to be able to break through. And in some of our relationships, we are beginning to see that the first glimmer of understanding emerging. And that is what I think is going to increasingly happen, because the way we characterize it, we said, what does our company do? I said, we take big data and convert it into small data. We create what we call a signal, a library of signals from big data, because that's the only thing that matters. Because who really cares? Most of big data is big noise anyway. And the problem is the current methods cannot distinguish. And so they keep everything. As one of the ways, yeah.
Just a quick question. Since you're working in India, with India for development purposes, have you seen any potential in helping the developing world by being the man element of this new equation, just like, you know, offshoring these functions of games and, you know, picking pieces of paper? Is that something you see happening?
I mean, it will happen, but I think this is one thing where, you know, offshoring, onshoring is less a question of division of labor, because this is really dealing with everybody, right? And for me, yes, you know, we of course look at that, but it's not something where because the main reason why people went to India, China, anywhere was cost, you know, and of course access to talent, right? But what we are finding increasingly here is that you have to solve this problem, you know, in the United States, you know, where the impact is most felt. So yes, I mean, for developmental reasons, I don't think countries like India really have much of a choice, right, because of the sheer size of the problem. But I do believe this is like the numeral zero. It'll affect everything.
Just about out of time. Do we have time for one more question if we have it?
Thank you.